We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. Well, for many years, people who had suffered with spinal cord injuries were told that if there was going to be improvement in their condition, it would come in the first few months of their recovery. And after 2 years, improvement was said to be almost impossible. However, our guest for this hour of the show, Dr. John McDonald, says that his experience tells him something different. In fact, he says that people with spinal cord injuries can always hope for recovery. Dr. McDonald is director of the International Center for Spinal Cord Injury. This is located at the Kennedy Krieger Institute in Baltimore, Maryland. This is a place where they work solely with people who have disorders and injuries of the brain, the spinal cord, and muscle, and most of the people that they serve are children. He came to Kennedy Krieger in 2005 to open the Center for Spinal Cord Injury, and he and his colleagues there are working at the cutting edge of innovative rehabilitative care for children and adults who live with spinal cord injuries. In addition to his work there at Kennedy Krieger, he is also a professor in the Department of Neurology at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. He's visiting the campus here to give a talk about his work as part of a symposium, Redefining Disability, New Directions in Research and Practice, sponsored by the Center on Health, Aging and Disability and the Health and Wellness Research Initiative here at the U of I. That's taking place this afternoon on the campus. And we're pleased that he could be here and spend a little time talking with us about some of the work that he's involved in. And we'll try to ask some basic questions and talk a little bit basically about spinal cord injury, but then talk about the work that he has done. And questions are welcome, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. And in addition, if you'd like to send along your question by email, you may do that as well. That's will-talk@illinois.edu. Thank you very much for being here.
Oh, I'm appreciate glad it. To be here.
Perhaps we could talk just a little bit generally about spinal cord injury to start. And I assume that probably when people hear that spinal cord injury, what they think of is injuries that result from some sort of traumatic event. We talk about could be car accident, could be sports related, could be something job related, a workplace kind of injury, some kind of traumatic injury that causes that damage to the spinal cord. Now, and that's certainly true, that is one category, but because you work with a lot of children, there are actually a lot of other things that can happen, and it can happen to you when you're young, that can result in a similar kind of damage. What are sort of some of the main things that you see with children?
Yeah, sure. So there's a number of medical causes of injury, both in children and adults. One condition in children is spina bifida, a term where basically you have maldevelopment of the nerves that go to the legs. And now we realize that's not a static problem, that evolves after the child's being born, and that early intervention can change the outcome of that disease. Other common things are actually intrauterine problems, such as bleeding or a stroke of the spinal cord. Mm-hmm. Infections are a common cause of spinal cord injury. And then primarily in adults, but also in some teenagers, there's neurodegenerative disorders that primarily affect the spinal cord. ALS, or Lou Gehrig's disease, is one of those. Lateral sclerosis is another. Multiple sclerosis is an inflammatory disease that affects both children and adults.
Okay. So, and the metaphor I'm sure that people use to try to understand what's going on here is maybe it's the electrical wiring metaphor, essentially, that they guess they sort of understand that in the spine, going down the spine, there are nerves, kind of like wires, and that they connect the brain with the rest of the body. And that's involved in doing things like all kinds of things like breathing, walking, manipulating things with your hands, a very wide range of very basic physical processes. And that when something happens to damage the wire, then that's when you get problems.
Yeah, that's exactly well put.
And that the variable effect, it has to do with where along that wire the damage occurs.
Yeah, that's correct. So, because two things happen, you know, as you eloquently described, you damage the wires that connect. Now, each level of the spinal cord in the middle sends out the connection to the actual body part. And so you'll damage that at different levels. So that's what will affect different levels of function.
Yeah. So depending if it's lower down, maybe that's where you have people who lose the use of their legs. Higher up, you might have people who literally lose the use of their entire body. They have difficulty breathing and everything else.
Yeah, exactly. So the most common things are, you know, with the cervical injuries or injuries at the neck, if they're high enough, you can't even control breathing, but you lose all functions below that level. Yeah. The next most common level is in the mid-thoracic zone, where you lose, you know, control of your lower body, but particularly bowel, bladder, and sexual function are big problem areas.
Yeah. Well, going back, I guess, to the wire metaphor, I suppose, I'm sure the question people ask is, you know, you understand that if you had a wire and you cut it, you could splice it back together. You could take the two pieces and you could twist them up and they would still transmit the electricity. Why can't you do that with a nerve?
So excellent question. And this is what scientists are wrestling with today. This is kind of the holy grail. How can we reconnect these long track circuits? And in today's world, we can't do that yet. But there's a number of different approaches. And this was the basis of my talk yesterday, are what are the barriers to that repair? Because the nervous system does have some ability to self-repair, but it actually encounters signals that say stop, turn around, go back the other direction. So the wires are trying to regrow and connect, but the same signals that are used to guide cars, for example, on the roads, now are rearranged in a nonsensical manner. Mm-hmm. You know, so if you want to go from Champaign to Chicago, now, you know, you're going to end up in Peoria.
Yeah. So, and is this, is it a, is the issue here the reason that they won't regrow by themselves, that's something that it's a process you see that it works, it tends to work earlier in life when the pathways are actually being set up, and a certain point comes when they just don't want to, they just don't do that anymore.
No, you hit the nail on the head. That is, we believe that early on, pretty much under the age of two, that if these pathways are damaged, they can reconnect, at least in a functional manner. Beyond that, the traditional view is that you've lost that ability or plasticity, and it's lost forever. Therefore, if you have an injury, it's over. And still, unfortunately, today, that's the motto, that the surgeon will come in and tell you within minutes of your injury that it's a hopeless situation and that there's real no chance of recovery. Because actually, we've been taught in medicine that that's realistic hope. And that's really nonsense.
Yeah. And that's, I assume, though, that the reason that you work with children, it has to do with the fact that though the younger the person is, and I'm sure the sooner you can begin your therapies after whatever the insult to the body was, your outcome is going to be better.
Yeah, exactly. So paradoxically, these young children have this unprecedented potential for a full recovery, yet they don't have access to any of the services. So the big specialty services in spinal cord injury or acute care are all evolved around adults. Mm-hmm. And there's really no specialties built up around children. So it's really serendipitous. Although they have the capacity, they don't get access to a system and therefore they don't get it. Now, the beauty of this is we used to believe, the old dogma was that you have time-delimited recovery, right, to months and years after your injury. What we now realize is that's not the case, that you can regain what you didn't get earlier long after the injury.
So, but having said what I said about you like to work with people as young as you can and soon as you can, you would also say that adults who have been living with the effects of spinal cord injury for a long time, there is still the possibility that therapy can benefit.
Yes, absolutely.
Let me just very quickly again introduce the guest for this hour of Focus 580. We're talking with Dr. John McDonald. He's director of the International Center for Spinal Cord Injury at the Kennedy Krieger Institute in Baltimore, Maryland, where they work with people who have disorders and injuries of the brain, the spinal cord, and muscle. And a lot of the people that they work with there are children. And he is here visiting the campus, gave a talk on his work yesterday. And questions here are certainly welcome. 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk.edu. Well, I want to have you talk about the kind of therapy that you do there, this thing that's called activity-based restorative therapies. What does that mean?
Yeah, so ABRT, or activity-based restorative therapy, is based on two principles. What we understand now is that the nervous system requires activation, or those wires need to be active in order to simply maintain themselves. Otherwise, they lose functionality. But more importantly, we now realize that your body and nervous system has the ability to do some self-repair. But unless activation of the system is appropriate, you won't achieve it. So we can achieve activation through movement. That's the number one way how activity gets through those electrical circuits normally. So how do you move someone who's paralyzed? Well, we can deliver electrical stimulation across the skin and stimulate the nerve endings on the muscle that are retained. So the beauty of the spinal cord injury is a disconnection problem, as you pointed out. But below that, the nervous system remains intact. So I can stimulate over the muscles of the legs and now using your own body power, drive those muscles so you ride a bicycle, for example. Mm-hmm. Now, we can do that in a way that you get all the physical benefits that we know you'll get from physical exercise. So the lack of access to exercise is the number one reason why individuals with paralysis develop complications and have a shortened lifespan and the huge costs that are associated with it. Those are all offsettable. We know that through exercise. It's just been in the past, how do you exercise someone like that? Modern technology now allows us to do this. We were able to develop essentially a functional electrical stimulation bike that can go in the home and that we can monitor at a distance. It's smart. It'll automatically take a paralyzed individual through the regimen and slowly work them up. Right. But the beauty is we do that activity in a way that we know that the nervous system likes in terms of activation of the nervous system. So as those legs and muscles are firing, they're sending constantly signals back to the spinal cord. The key is below the level of the injury, the spinal cord that remains intact and healthy slowly degrades. And if we can optimize that activity, then we can offset that. And then on top of that, now then we can realize the small amount of repair that the body is able to do. So we used to believe that someone who had a severe injury, that below the level of the injury, if they couldn't feel or move anything, it was a complete injury, that there was no connections across that lesion. The imaging techniques couldn't detect that. Now we have imaging techniques that tell us, even in the most severe cases, the majority of those individuals have about 30% of the anatomical wires across that lesion. Trouble is, most of them aren't working properly. Why? Well, the number one reason is they're lacking their insulation around those wires, something we call myelination, something that is lost, in, for example, in multiple sclerosis. But those wires are there. We now, you know, the nervous system now we understand is continually making cells that are capable of doing that insulation. But without activation, they don't get the proper signals to say, reach out and myelinate or wrap me. So that's something your body can do. With proper activation, we can achieve that. And most people that have 30% of their connections can achieve really what we call a pragmatic recovery. We know that even in humans, and this has been well delineated in animal models, that you only need about 20% of functional connections across a lesion in order to walk again or have bowel and bladder function. Now, we're not all the way there yet. With the type of equipment that we have and the home-based therapies that we can apply, we can achieve important improvements in function. For example, getting someone off a ventilator who's on a ventilator to breathe on their own, use of a hand for someone who doesn't have use of a hand, recovery of bowel and bladder function for someone who doesn't have that. If someone can stand but can't walk, walking. So very important stepwise improvements like recovery of sensation and things like that. Technology is what's limiting us to achieve the full potential. And now we're in the process of working with engineering groups. And that's one of the reasons why I'm here, because the institution here at Champaign-Urbana in Illinois, they have a vision of an integrated healthcare system focused on education for the chronic period of healthcare delivery, which is really the essence of what we're talking about. That is, most people that have an injury, they're living at home. They don't have access to a center, so they can't receive center-based therapies. But with smart technology, we can put this in the home and make it user-friendly.
Well, what's the cost of say, one of these electric nerve-stimulating bikes?
Yeah, so one of the limitations right now is, typically the process of the FDA and federal reimbursement. So these devices are reimbursed by private insurance. The cost is about $15,000. And the reason for that is that they sell very few of them. So unfortunately, that's still a barrier. It takes time, but it's achievable. you know, with these medical devices, because they're really a necessity.
Yeah. Well, what do you think is the potential market, that is, in terms of people that you know who are out there who might actually benefit from this?
Yeah, sure. You know, in terms of all forms of paralysis, the numbers are really, really high. So, in fact, you know, half of the U.S. has some level of disability of mobility, either from orthopedic injury, aging, diabetes, multiple sclerosis, neurodegenerative diseases, and non-neurologic diseases. In terms of spinal cord injury, there's well over 1 million people out there that could benefit from this technology.
Yeah. Well, you know, I've said, and one of the things that you say is that people who are living with spinal cord injury, even if it's been a long time, should never abandon hope. Don't give up the idea that you could actually recover some function. But, you know, also acknowledging what you say about the fact that, say, you have this kind of injury, and so that means then these muscles and these nerves, you're not using them, and that they will, without the use, they will deteriorate over a period of time. So is there truly, though, some sort of line where you say, you know, given a certain number of years past the point of your injury, there is going to be we're not going to say that it's zero, but we're going to say that maybe it's a diminishing capacity for regeneration.
No, and I think that's well put. So the way I would put it is that after an injury, imagine this like accelerated aging. Just as your body ages, so does your nervous system. And you accumulate those problems. And every medical complication that you have, whether it's skin breakdown or loss of bone density or a broken bone, those are all working against you. So the accumulation of those complications diminishes your capacity for recovery. The slow aging of the nervous system in the body is also something that accumulates and limits your capacity for recovery. So although, yes, the capacity for recovery does diminish, but it never goes away completely. The majority of your capacity to recovery is still retained.
Hmm. Now, I just wonder now if you have a device, say you have someone who has lost the use of his or her legs. So you have this kind of device, which what you do with your electronic stimulation of the muscles, what you're actually doing is like putting this person on an exercise bike. And even though they might at one point not be able to get up and walk, you can make it so that their legs will go and those muscles will benefit. And I guess you actually get the same cardio benefit that anybody would get. Is the idea that you could develop a kind of a device that would work in a similar sort of way with, for example, the upper body? Could you have something that would be in effect like lifting weights so that you would also develop the muscles of the upper body?
Yeah, very good point. So one of the keys is developing a universal, smart, portable system that can do more than just cause biking, can do upper extremity, trunk, all the different components that we need to do, again, in a pragmatic way that can be done at the home or at the office. And, you know, that's the vision where we're going. Because one of the problems out there now is that companies are developing individual technology like this FES bike, and therefore it's very expensive because only a small number are used. If everyone can use a similar device, then the costs markedly fall.
And now you're also I've looked at your website and look at some of the other things that you do. You also do, now this is obviously not something that everybody could do because you have to have a pool, but you also do water therapy?
Yes, that's correct. Something we call aquatherapy. And we do this on land, too. One of the key approaches is let's partially eliminate the bearings of gravity so that it's easier for you to move. So many individuals, when you first put them in the pool, they realize for the first time that they can actually move their leg. That is extremely motivating. And now their nervous system can learn, retrain to control that. And actually that retraining can occur within minutes. You know, so we do the same thing on land. For example, it will partially bear your body weight, so that you can practice a more normal gait if you have some movement of your legs but can't walk independently. So we have a graduated system of anti-gravity approaches, you know, really ending with water, which is the most anti-gravity approach.
Yeah.
Allows you to more effectively cross-train the recovery that you already have and work out in a more uniform, effective manner.
Well, that's interesting that here, if people go to your website, they can see a photograph of this thing called partial weight-supported walking, which essentially means that you put somebody in a kind of a harness that will hold them in a standing position, will support their weight, and then you have therapists that are working with that person to, if that person can't move their legs the way that you would when you're walking, apparently they will do that and try to do it in a way so that the gait is correct, and that way you can actually start a person who perhaps could not walk back towards being able to walk.
Right. And that's well put. I mean, in our case, our magic pill is our therapist. And mm-hmm. those therapists do a lot in the areas where we don't have technology. This still requires this manual approach and an integration using a human brain to most effectively accomplish the task.
Yeah. I was just going to ask back when you were talking about the cycling with functional electrical stimulation, the thing, the electrical stimulating exercise bike. How often do you recommend that a person do it? I mean, how much exercise is necessary to get that effect?
Yeah, so the critical threshold is 3 hours of kind of mild to moderate physical activity. So that's equivalent of an hour of FES cycling three times a week. Now, it is better to do more. And on average, you know, an individual living at home with a disability integrated back in life can at maximum, you know, do about 6 hours of home-based therapy. So typically what we recommend for people that need the FES bike are 3 hours of FES biking a week. And then you offset the rest of that with exercises that the therapists have taught you and using other surface stimulation, for example, the upper extremity. So there's this pragmatic limit of what's doable. Hmm. But the key threshold from the science has been that you need a minimum of 3 hours. With that minimum of 3 hours, you get the majority of the physical benefits and offset most of the complications that are predictable with paralysis.
This, I would be curious, obviously the person to ask would be someone who has done this. What it, for someone who perhaps hasn't walked in some time, what that feels like? Does it feel good? Does it feel strange? Does it feel painful? What do people say about what the experience is like for them?
So it's variable, but the uniform factor of it is it's an amazing feeling to that individual and extremely motivating. That even the first time that an individual with paralysis is in a pool, it's an incredible thing. For example, I worked with Christopher Reeve. 5 years after his injury, he'd never been put in a pool because you can't put a ventilated person in a pool. Well, of course you can. So we did. And now, you know, the administration said it can only be in for 5 minutes, right? You know, he stayed in for an hour and 15 because no one could tell that man with a smile from ear to ear because it was the first time he was weightless. Yeah. That was the first time he could realize he could move his legs on his own. Imagine the motivation of that.
We have a couple of callers here. Let me take just a moment to introduce again our guest, Dr. John McDonald. He's director of the International Center for Spinal Cord Injury at the Kennedy Krieger Institute in Baltimore, Maryland. He came to the institute in 2005 to open the International Center for Spinal Cord Injury, and there they do work helping people, both children and adults, who live with spinal cord injuries. The institute, the Kennedy Krieger Institute, is primarily focused on people who have disorders and injuries of the brain, the spinal cord, and muscle, and a lot of the people that they work with are children. He is also associate professor in the Department of Neurology at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. Visiting here, the campus gave a talk about his work yesterday. He's a graduate of the University of Illinois. Interestingly enough, as we talked in the beginning, you started out in electrical engineering. Maybe not so surprising that you would then become a neurologist.
Yeah.
All right. Let's talk with several callers. First, Sycamore up in the northern part of the state. Line 4. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Fascinating topic, and I really appreciate hearing about it. And I was wondering if your guest would discuss the problem that I've heard happens with later in life with victims of polio that contracted polio early in life and were able to achieve a fair amount of functionality and recovery through therapy and other means, and then went through the middle part of their life reasonably well, and then later on turn up with some unusual difficulties. I'm not real familiar with all of that, and I'm hoping you can discuss that.
All right. Can you?
Yes, absolutely. So What you're describing is actually a common phenomenon. It's called post-polio syndrome. And the mechanisms aren't exactly understood, but I can tell you this best analogy, that essentially what's happening is, imagine after the initial injury, despite having recovery, there's an injury to the nervous system, particularly the spinal cord, and you've lost a number of the cells that are important for movement. What happens is after that, that nervous system is undergoing accelerated aging. So although everyone would run into the same problem, and it would that now with the once you've had polio, that now it occurs within 10 to 15 to 20 to 30 years that you redevelop, start developing paralysis again because you've met now a critical threshold of cells. So with accelerated aging, you slowly lose the cells that you have. But remember, because of the original injury, you've already taken a hit and a number of those cells are gone. So you reach that critical threshold sooner than someone who's never had an injury. And that's essentially post-polio syndrome. And we believe that this type of activity-based approach can offset that accelerated approach and actually harness some repair. So I think this approach will be very useful in that arena. And we've treated a number of individuals with post-polio syndrome. So it's also not a hopeless situation.
Well, very good. Thank you so much.
All right, thank you. Let's talk next with someone here in Champaign County. This is line one. Hello.
Yeah, I'm curious. You've gone the whole half hour without mentioning anything about you know, maybe the magic bullet therapies of stem cells in conjunction with. I realize you're focused on the activity-based solution, which I presume sort of relies on naturally occurring undifferentiated cells. But there are other things, too, that are less controversial. Plasma-rich, platelet-rich plasma injections in conjunction with exercise and therapy. And I was thinking also of there's some human growth factors that are being used. Is your institute not doing those kind of sort of conjunct therapies? And do you know the literature if people are? Or what do you think?
Yeah, excellent question. So, yeah, absolutely. Our center is dedicated to developing a cure. The majority of our research is focused in that arena and using both human and mouse embryonic stem cells. So let me just make a comment in this arena that those approaches are very important for the cure. The approach that we're talking about today, ABRT, is, you can imagine, is meeting the cure halfway. That is, if I had the magic pill today, say it's a purple pill, and it basically, if you took it, it would return everyone's nervous system to the state it was the day before their injury. No one would have a cure. Why? Because they've accumulated the aging effects, both in the nervous system and their body and the complications. So ABRT is meeting the cure halfway. So the other half of our effort is using stem cells. And surprisingly, one of the avenues that ABRT is working through is the inherent stem cells or progenitor cells that are in your spinal cord. Over 100,000 new cells are birthed with electrical stimulation every hour in the rodent spinal cord. And that's what contributes to the remyelination or reinsulation. So, yes, you're right. And there's a number of clinical trials that are ongoing now. And in the next 2 years, there'll be over 12 human clinical trials evaluating a series of different approaches to overcome the barriers to regeneration, not just myelination, but axonal regrowth. And that's really, you know, the result of a number of scientists working in this area over this last decade and the growth that's occurred in that arena. So excellent question. And I don't think we have the time to discuss any of those individual approaches, but there's an intersection between those curative therapies and this restorative therapy. And actually, there's a biological overlay in that stem cells, we envision, are important for both. Because mainly, you know, human embryonic stem cells is really the single greatest discovery of the century. Not so much as a direct therapy, but as a diagnostic tool to understand disease, like neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's.
Does that get at your question?
I understand that there's other stuff going on, but well, what you are doing, and you've just pointed at this generation of undifferentiated cells by electrical stimulation, and I guess you did point at that earlier, but maybe you could elaborate on that a little more. I mean, how do you understand the mechanism? You're sort of accelerating the natural production of these Or am I misunderstanding that?
No, you're exactly right. So really we're taking advantage of a large body of research that's already been done during development. That the majority of the processes that are important for regeneration, namely cell birth, survival, migration, pathfinding, fate, choice, and myelination, that they're dependent on electrical activation. And if electrical activation is impaired, then those processes won't work as well. The key thing after an injury to the nervous system is that in the normal nervous system below the level of the injury, activity is so far reduced that it's predicted to markedly impair those processes. We now understand that those processes also occur in the adult nervous system, and that restoring activation, which has been the primary focus of our research, can actually restore those to their full capacity.
We have another caller, someone here on a cell phone. This is line number one. Hello.
Good morning, Dr.
Yes.
McDonald. I had a brother that he was a C3, 4 complete and quadriplegic, and he, by sheer, can't find the word, but anyway, he was on a ventilator for the first year of his, after his injury, and then by sheer courage was able to be off of it. But what I was concerned about was, do quadriplegics now receive more treatment than just range of motion every day? I mean, the insurance company wasn't really willing to put much in his treatment, although he lived 12 years after injury. And I was just concerned if more was being done today. And also, another question is, what are they doing in Europe? Are there advances in Europe that maybe we don't have here that could be discussed? And then as a something a little unrelated to the previous caller, I don't know, I think you were from the St. Louis area originally.
Yes.
Do you know if Jenny Gazette International Networking Institute is still around? They used to be the place to go for post-polio matters.
No, I'm not aware that they're still around.
Okay. And I'll take my answers off here.
All right. Is the question clear with the call?
Yeah, so let me just address the first question on the air, which is, yes, so much more is being done today just across this last decade with paralysis, particularly quadriplegia. And I think Christopher Reeve was a good example. He wasn't an exception. 10 years ago, very little would be done with someone other than, as you pointed out, range of motion. And that really hasn't changed for the 30 years before that. But as a result of Chris and efforts of many, like your brother, that we do realize that recovery is possible long after the injury. And that's what got us started in this direction. So now during the acute rehabilitative phase, a lot more is done other than range of motion, such as using functional electrical stimulation, aquatherapy, and partial body weight supported walking. But what's really critical and the main push of our center is that this is needed across the lifetime. So the chronic therapy needs to be done in the home. So an individualized lifelong home-based program involving these modalities in such a way that it can be done in less than 6 to 8 hours a week is necessary in order to maintain the benefits and to maximize the capacity for recovery. And technology is now allowing this to happen. And actually, University of Illinois here is very interested in moving into this arena with their history of integrated education and healthcare.
We have as our guest this morning, and let me introduce Dr. John McDonald. He's director of the International Center for Spinal Cord Injury at the Kennedy Krieger Institute in Baltimore, Maryland, where they work with people who have injuries, disorders of the brain, the spinal cord, and muscle. Most of the people they work with are children, and they're doing a lot of cutting-edge work on doing rehabilitation for people of all ages who are living with spinal cord injuries, and that's what we're talking about here this morning. Questions, welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and you may also send us an email if you like. That's will-talk at illinois.edu. Let's take another caller here, and I think that this is line one, and this is somebody on a cell phone. Hello.
Hi. I want to ask a question that goes in a slightly different direction, and I don't know whether you can answer it or not, but I'm interested in optic nerve damage and whether any of your work with spinal cord damage or spinal nerves damage also is relevant for optic nerve damage, which once you have it, you lose vision in that eye. And so I'm interested to hear what you have to say about that, if anything.
Yeah, so excellent point. So the answer is broadly yes. That is, the optic nerve also depends on activity in order to optimize its own recovery, because the same insulation problem is a problem in the optic nerve. The optic nerve is basically a very small spinal cord. And there's a number of companies that have developed visual systems based on computer graphics that can be done, kind of the equivalent of what we do with FES, that can optimally help that. And I don't have that information with me, but I'd be happy to direct that information to this institute.
And if I was interested in that, who would I contact, or?
Yeah, so I think, you know, what I can do, I don't have the information with me, but I'd be happy to give it to the station here, and then you could perhaps access it.
Sure.
Okay. Thank
right.
you.
Thank you. I have an email here from someone who was said they'd be interested in your response to a therapy that they saw on PBS several years ago. Apparently, this involved doctors transplanting nerves from an individual's nose to alongside the location in the spine where there was the injury, and that they picked nasal nerves because apparently they will regrow. One of the recipients was a young woman. She was not able to regain her ability to walk, but did apparently regain some sensory inputs from the area below the injury.
So what this person is writing in about is what we call olfactory and sheathing glia, and these are very special supportive cells that do the insulation of the nerves that are involved in smell. And one of the unique things about your system for smelling is that those nerves are constantly regrowing. So the concept was that these supporting cells have some special function that support regeneration recovery. So that was why it was investigated in spinal cord injury. Now, what you're referring to are the early phase one trials that were done to evaluate this. And they're primarily used to evaluate safety. So there's really no control group, so you can't really interpret recovery of function. But it is safe to transplant these, and I think there's a number of commercial entities that are interested in pushing that forward to a therapy. Right now, there's no active trial of olfactory sheathing glia in the United States or in Europe.
I'm trying to get in my non-medical way to get an understanding about what's going on when a nerve is broken or cut, and what you're trying to get it to do. And as I think about it, it seems the problem that you say you have these two nerves, and you wonder, well, why is it that the two halves can't sort of look at each other and say, hey, wait a minute, didn't we used to be connected? Let's just reach over and grab and connect back up again. It's just something about them. Is it that they don't know how? That they don't recognize that part over there used to be connected over here?
Yeah, so the old view was that exactly that the cell can no longer recognize what it needs to do. Mm-hmm. We now realize that's not the case, but that there's a series of barriers in the way, and let me walk through those. Okay. The first barrier is that there's tissue missing, and you need to bridge across that. You can't walk across an empty lake, right? But two, around there is a scar, and in that scar tissue are actually these misappropriated street signs. They give you false directions.
Okay.
So instead of guiding you in the right place, they're actually telling you to go in the wrong place. So it's misaligned development. Beyond that, there's a number of other barriers. Other molecules are necessary in order to guide the connection to its final place. And then once it does make its appropriate connection, the system needs to learn and choose those selections that work. And then those wires need to be insulated or myelinated. So those are the barriers that we're facing, and there's a number of different strategies to address each one of those barriers that are moving forward now towards clinical trials.
Okay. Well, that actually makes a lot of sense. So partly what you're doing with stem cells then is what you're trying to do is put a patch in there to restore the break. Now, there's other things that you have to do, like, for example, again, going back to your wire metaphor, replacing the insulation once you have actually established a connection and some other things. But so essentially that's what you're doing with the stem cells?
Yeah, so exactly. So in the case of, like, for example, olfactory and sheathing glia, they can only do one thing because they're normally supposed to be in the nose. They can only insulate. So they can't do the other things. Now, if we take a stem cell and put it in the nervous system, it can not only give the information to make the reconnection, but it can make the cells that can do the insulation. It can make the other supportive cells. It can even make the neurons that make the connections. So, but more importantly, there's a series of things that we don't understand that are important in this serial message. But if you put cells in there at an early stage, They do know what to do. They send the right signals in the environment and modify to make it look like normal development. So we don't need to understand everything, and that's one of the discoveries around using stem cells.
Okay, other callers. Champagne, this is line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
McDonald.
Yes.
Well, I had a couple of comments, questions, I guess, and comments. The first was about the cost of the machines. Could these things be used for, like, sports medicine? I mean, I know this isn't the intent, but just to help people build muscle mass at home, I mean, would it have that effect where it could stimulate the nervous system or maybe to improve reflexes? That's kind of my first question. If you don't want to address it, that's okay, because I understand it's not the purpose of the therapy. But I thought, you know, it might lower cost by making more people willing to buy the machines. The second thing was, can these same procedures that you're going for, do they work for large nerves? So I had a friend that got stabbed at a bar fight, and it severed his, a thing called the brachial plexus up in his shoulder somewhere. And he lost, like, he can still move his hand, which is weird, but, like, he can't move his arm at all. Could this be used for that? And I guess those are my questions.
Yeah, so excellent questions. So we are taking the exact approach that you mentioned, which is let's develop a universal device that can be used for many things other than just disability, so the costs markedly drop. And that's a, you know, a 3 to 5 year process, but that's been initiated. And I think a number of groups are going down that line. The second approach is that with a peripheral nerve injury or a brachial plexus injury like your friend had, that activity can also help that, given that the nerves are still connected. So the real beauty of the what we call the peripheral nervous system, or the nerves that run from the spinal cord to the arm, like was injured in your friend, those do have a greater capacity to regenerate on their own. But if the nerve is severed, they need to be reconnected surgically. And if that's been done or they're only partially severed, then there is this potential. And yes, that the same type of electrical activity can stimulate long-term repair.
Yeah, he does seem to be getting better. The other thing, then, is for the spinal cord. Are the nerves in the spinal cord like the ones in your shoulder where, like, they're already separate? Like, I guess so, like, you mentioned that nerves, like, come out at different levels, you said. Are those nerves, like, distinct in the spinal cord? Because, like, when I go online and look at a picture of the spinal cord, it's just, like, this blob of, like, gray stuff and white stuff. But, like, is it actually separate nerves in the white and the gray stuff already, or does that only happen when they come out the sides?
Yeah, so it's kind of a gradient across that, a continuum, that in the spinal cord, there's some intermixing, but yes, there's basically you can put a map on the spinal cord that that corresponds with the different levels of nerves that come out. But as you go higher and higher in the spinal cord, they get more and more mixed, even though they're still
okay.
Regionally localized. So, yeah, they don't start looking like that peripheral nerve until they actually start coming out.
Oh, because I was thinking, like, maybe you could surgically – I mean, if you got paralysis, you're already kind of in a bad situation. But maybe you could, like, go in and open up surgery and maybe – actually kind of pull out the nerve that got cut specifically, and maybe there's some chemical you could put on it that would make it think, hi, I'm a... Because we learned about, like, what do they call axons and stuff. Like, back in high school, I mean, that's how the nerves talk to each other. They release some kind of chemical, and it got picked up on the other side. And, like, maybe you could put chemicals just in there to make those nerves kind of connect to the other nerve. I mean, I know it would screw the nerve up a little bit, but at least that nerve would still be running down to, say, their foot versus... it messing up and connecting a foot input to, I don't know, your quadriceps or something like that.
Yeah, and that's exactly one of the problems. You know, like the peripheral nerve, it has this conduit that can tell that guide the new growing connections. The trouble in the nervous system is that after an injury, there isn't this little conduit that will guide them in the right direction. And so scientists are taking a number of different strategies, including using glue and other things to approximate that, but also including, you know, electrical devices to actually bridge from one area of the nervous system to another. But suffice it to say that that's kind of the holy grail, the most difficult arena that is accomplishable, but it's going to take more time.
Well, thank you. I'm going to hang up, but keep listening. This is very interesting.
Thank you. I have an email here from someone who writes that she's 32, is a T4 paraplegic, and says that as early as 1981 knew about some versions of the thing that we've talked about, the cycling with functional electrical stimulation. And in fact said they saw someone who was paraplegic using one of these electrical bicycles in either 1983 or 1984. It goes on to write, we've known about the myelin sheaths or sheathing at least 20 years and stem cells even longer. What's taking so long to accomplish the task?
Yeah, so, you know, excellent question, because that's the same thing I asked when I first got into this arena. So it's a number of barriers that have gotten in the way. Technology is the number one thing. So you're exactly right. FES has been around for 50 years. FES bikes have been around for 30 years. But they haven't the advanced technology that we use every day hasn't been translated to medicine. So, for example, the other FES bikes that you're referring to were giant. They're half the size of a car. They couldn't really effectively be used in the home. There was no motor to move the legs and support the legs. So it wasn't a practical solution, and new technology needed to be applied to accomplish that. So technology is a major barrier. Even though it's out there, it's not being applied in this arena. The other major barrier is shifting major beliefs of dogma in a field. So, for example, when physicians and clinicians believe that something's impossible, they sign off pretty quick. And it takes a lot of maneuvering in order to overcome that. And it takes time that with the clinicians, they need to experience it themselves and not just read a paper on it or not just hear from someone else that this is doable. And that's what's taken time. It takes visibility in mobility in that arena. And that's what we've seen with Christopher Reeve and other individuals like Fox, who brought these disabilities to the average public attention and made them an important problem. And I think with our injured soldiers coming back, that's raised awareness that's now markedly accelerating the movement of this. And this is why that you'll see that 10 years ago, there were no human trials in spinal cord injury. And you know, next year, there'll be 10 to 12 therapies. And that's an amazing thing in the amount of progress in a decade.
One more caller we'll try to get in the time that remains. This is someone in Champaign and in line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I tuned in late, so I'm not quite sure if this has been addressed or even if it's appropriate. I have a grandson with cerebral palsy, and I know that's a totally different problem because it's brain injury, not spinal. But he is a quadriplegic. Is there anything going on to try to help children like him, get more efficient use of their limbs? Because he can't right now really grasp anything, or, you know, he can move, but he can't control any of his movement.
Right, absolutely. So let me explain that in general, although different neurologic injuries are caused by different things, and but the end result's identical. Cells are lost, connections are broken, and connections that still exist don't have demyelination. And loss of that insulation is a key problem in cerebral palsy. You don't actually lose a lot of the connections. They're still there. They're just not functioning properly. That's why he can move, but he doesn't have adequate control over that movement. Mm-hmm. And the answer is yes, absolutely. This type of activity-based restorative therapy approach can be used. It's particularly effective with gait and trunk function and even upper extremity function. We treated a large number of children with cerebral palsy. That's another focus of the center. And there's a lot of benefits. In fact, in many cases, it's more doable to give recovery to children with cerebral palsy than spinal cord injury. So I think there's even more hope in that arena. And you can, you know, contact our center and get more information on that.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you. And I did have an email. So this is something we've touched on here at points, but I do want to raise the question because someone wanted to know whether the kind of therapies we're talking about are of use with multiple sclerosis or other kind of degenerative disorders. And I think the answer is yes.
The answer is yes. And in fact, you know, MS, or multiple sclerosis, is an ideal condition because the majority of the anatomical connections or wires still remain. All that needs to be stimulated is that regrowth of the cells that do the insulation. So MS is a very large population that we treat at the center because we also treat adults. And there's a form of MS that occurs in children that we're actively treating as well. So, yes, it can be equally applied there.
So what, in as far as stem cell work is going, at what stage are you actually doing trials with humans now?
So our center is not participating in a trial right now. But, yes, there is an active trial that's ongoing. The company Geron is sponsoring it. Mm-hmm. It's using human embryonic stem cell-derived progenitor cells that are differentiated towards the nervous system. And they're so far differentiated that they can only make those supportive cells, like the insulating cells. And they're using those in transplanting. And now, as I'm aware of it, I think two individuals have been transplanted as part of a phase one safety trial. And the first individual was transplanted down in Atlanta at the Shepherd Center. And they hope to have this safety study done over the next year. And then if that's demonstrated to be safe, they can move forward in phase two and three trials, which are designed to really determine efficacy. How much can we really help with this?
And how many years does it take to work a process like this through?
So, you know, typically moving through the clinical trials will take, you know, 5 to 10 years. So I think in this case, it'll be a minimum of 5 more years before there's either a potential therapy or it's proven that it doesn't work.
Yeah. Something else, and I don't know if this is too science fiction-y, but if you have an individual where the nerves and the ability to transmit is, say, intact above the injury and below the injury, and what you're just trying to do is reestablish the connection, what is there some other way, rather than knitting the nerves up, couldn't there be some way that you could put a transmitter on one side and a receiver on the other and bridge the gap that way without having to knit the nerves back up?
Yes. So the answer is, this is not just science fiction anymore. This is actually beginning to happen in animal models. For example, you can sense the activity of cells in your brain, translate that down to controlling movement. And this has been done in non-human primates or monkeys to actually pick up food and using a robotic limb that they control only with their brain. So these what called brain-machine interfaces are actually becoming realized today. In fact, it was one of the topics of one of the other faculty at University of Illinois's lecture yesterday.
Well, we're at the point where we're going to have to finish. But if people would like to learn more about the Kennedy Krieger Institute or specifically their National Center for Spinal Cord Injury there, you have various kinds of information on the web. So as long as people have web access, they can go to the website?
Yeah, exactly. I think the web site will direct them in all the directions they need to go.
All right. Our guest, Dr. John McDonald, he is director of the International Center for Spinal Cord Injury at the Kennedy Krieger Institute in Baltimore, Maryland. He is also associate professor in the Department of Neurology at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. Here, visiting the campus to talk about his work. Thank you very much for being here.
Oh, it's an honor to be here.